Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. And my guest is Ben Emlyn Jones. Ben is joining us from the UK. He recently attended a conference about the, and I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it correctly, the Penturk or Pentersh event. Ben will enlighten us about the correct pronunciation, which was a key event not too long ago, actually. And it's an event that's been shrouded in mystery, and a lot of the witnesses have been harassed. We've heard that story before, but the British military has been able to really put a clamp down on this particular subject. So I wanted Ben to come on and talk about what he learned at the conference, and also about his life and his voyage of discovery. So without any further ado, Ben Emlyn Jones, welcome to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
Oh, thanks very much, James. It's great to be here. Great to be on the show with you today. And it's actually pronounced, it's Pentyrch or Pentyrch, is how you pronounce it. I come from Wales actually, so I'm a fellow Taffy. So even though I live in Oxford, I'm an expat, been exiled. I still, they say you take the boy out of Wales, but you can't take Wales out of the boy. And so that's how I feel about it. It's just maybe one of the reasons I'm so passionate about this case and why I was willing to investigate it, in fact, or to report on it as a journalist before anyone else was. A lot of other people weren't even interested, but I was back in the early days.
Take us to the beginning. What was the date and what were the circumstances leading up? Give us our listeners a word picture of the town and the countryside.
Well, yeah, Pentyrch is a small little village in these very hilly areas, the Rhondda Valley, and they say part of South Wales, which is an undulating landscape of deep valleys and high hills leading up to the Brecon Beacons and the Cambrian Mountains. And Pentyrch is a small village. It's actually quite isolated, even though it's actually just a short drive north of Cardiff, the capital city. And it is actually a very beautiful place, I would say. In nice weather at least. And the Pentyrch is a village with just I think it's 2,800 people live there, so it's not a big place. And Kaz Clark, the main witness, is one that actually has lived there for a while. She actually comes from the West Country of England, so she's not Welsh, but she has lived in Pentyrch for a number of years and has a house there with her family. And there's lots of neighbors on the street where she lives and in the village. And this all happened in late February of 2016. There was a strange, large amount of aircraft flying overhead. This is when people realized something was going strange. Going on. A large number of aircraft flying overhead, day and night. They were flying all the time. Helicopters, there were various propeller planes, jet planes, things like that. And a few people who know about aircraft spotted the airborne early warning system, the AWACS, which is possibly an American aircraft because there is an American presence, military presence on our soil still in the post-Cold War. And there's several Royal Air Force aircraft, including a spotter plane, was positively identified and was visible on flight tracker. This went on for several days, and people were concerned because, although there are exercises, military exercises that take place in the area, including one that happens about once a year called Exercise Chameleon. It doesn't. It's the actual activity is not as intense as this. What you normally get, you might hear a few bangs from thunder flashes, exercise ordnance, and some flares in the sky, maybe a couple of helicopters. This is a normal military exercise that takes place in various parts of the country, and including South Wales. This was far more intense than that. And it went on for longer. It went on for several days, and people couldn't sleep. And people were sitting up at night trying to just talk about what was going on. Now, in the early hours of the 20, about 2 a.m. on the 26th of February, everyone was in a person's house in their garden and looking up at the sky as aircraft were flying over, and they saw a number of red lights, a line of red lights appear in the sky. They thought, this is strange. So they immediately ran out of their house and out of their houses up the a very, very short distance to an alleyway that leads to a gate by a field, a big farmer's pasture. And when they were by the gate, they saw these more lights appeared, and they appeared in a kind of triangle shape. And pretty soon, what we saw was appearing out of thin air, as if from a magician's hat. It didn't come up or down. It just seemed to appear. Kaz describes it as decloaking. This is a science fiction term, but it means it was invisible and it slowly became invisible. It slowly became visible, as if it was coming out of a mist or something. Was a very large tetrahedral object, like a three-sided pyramidal object. I mean, when I say large, it's based on where we believe it touched the ground or came close to the ground. It would have been several hundred feet across, along each side, the size of a large block of flats, a city block or something like that, in a city, and it was hovering in the air. At the same time, what happened was one point of the tetrahedron came close to the ground, and lightning bolts, what looked like lightning bolts or electric discharges, were released from the bottom of the craft towards the ground, as if it was like firing lightning bolts at the ground. And then several other objects appeared. There were two objects shaped like a barrel, a kind of cylindrical barrel-shaped object. There were two of them, actually. One was red and glowing brightly, and the other was blue and sorry, green. One was red and one was green, and they were glowing with very, very bright internal light. And they flew around for a while, and they came very close to Kaz. One of them came very, very close to the spot at the gate where she was. It hovered over a hedge, and it flew up and hovered near a tree. And this was literally just a few feet away. After a few minutes of this, the object slowly faded from view. It returned to its invisible state, the light slowly disappearing. The object itself was described as brown in color. This was is at night time, so it's often difficult to discern this. And it kind of had a rough surface, as if it was made of metal or stone or something like that. And the object died, then just slowly faded away. And this is just what I've heard. I mean, obviously the witnesses themselves could tell you the story better than I have, but I'm familiar with the story. I've heard it many times, and so that's kind of what they saw. This really shocked them. They tried to get their phone cameras out and film it, but their phones weren't working. This often happens, I find, that something goes wrong with electronics nearby these objects. A good example of that is the Cashlandrum incident of 1980, where two ladies were driving along and they their car wouldn't work. Their car and engine stopped. Things like that often happens when strange objects are around in close encounters. It's dramatized very well in Steven Spielberg's film Close Encounters of the Third Kind, where the guy's driving his little truck and he stops at a level crossing. And the engine goes off, and the radio goes off, and his torch switched off. You've seen the film, I expect. So that's kind of what it was like. Now, at the same time, something else was going on nearby in the town of Llantrisant, which is a few miles away. This is a larger town where there is a lot of there's some large there's some big there's a big shopping centre, there's a big hospital, and there is the Royal Mint as well, which is where all our money comes from. Not there's a connection there. But there's a very high hill nearby covered in forest called Smilog Woods. And the hospital now, I was a hospital porter for 23 years. So we worked in my hospital, we worked closely with the Ministry of Defence on exercises and things like that. And this is one reason I know that what happened couldn't possibly be a military exercise myself. There was a loud explosion. This wasn't exercise ordnance, this was a live warhead detonating. And this was so loud that it shook the Royal Glamorgan Hospital. It was like it shook the building like an earthquake. This hospital, the Royal Glamorgan Hospital. Now, there's no way a military exercise could ever do that. Night in the middle of the night near an acute care hospital is very dangerous. Very dangerous indeed. You have patients there in intensive care. This sort of thing could kill people. And what happened after that was that the following day, the whole area of Smilog Woods was sealed off. There were policemen with roadblocks, and you couldn't go in there. And they said, you can't come in. And now there was a lot of question. This lasted for a couple of days, this presence. There were several new witnesses, actually, at this event I went to, the 10th anniversary event, that actually saw some of the activity going on, and there were some people they weren't there, they didn't give witness testimony, but they have been interviewed, who actually they were actually kidnapped. Two people camping in tents were kidnapped, And they basically dragged away, so that because something was going on in Smilog Woods. Now, this went on for a couple of days. It's very similar to the Roswell incident of 1947, where an area gets sealed off, and you get like the police or military going in there and doing something. Usually, in this case, in the case of Roswell, it's to remove decisive forensic evidence. In other words, in the case of Roswell, it was a flying saucer and aliens. In this case, it may well have been something similar. Now, after a number of days, the forest was reopened, but a large area had been cleared. There was a huge new glade had been created, and there were broken tree stumps, indicating that a lot of trees had been felled. At the same time, there are also some trees nearby that appeared to have been broken by some kind of impact, some kind of kinetic impact, as if something large had crashed into them, like an aircraft. And now the Kaz and the Gary Jones, I must pay particular tribute to Kaz Clark, who's the principal witness and has done more than anyone else to publicize this event, and also Gary Jones, who was a field researcher who did a lot of the legwork in getting the data on this incident. They wrote off to various authorities, the Forestry Commission, the local council, the Ministry of Defence, and they got back a number of replies. One of them was that the Smilog Woods have been closed due to ash dieback disease. Now, this is a deadly disease of trees. It's a fungus that kills trees. And they didn't want people going in there and spreading it around, because if you walk in there, the fungus can actually, the spores can actually be attached to your clothing, your boots, your skin, and you could move it to another part of the forest and infect more trees. But this is simply false, because there was no record before then of ash dieback disease, none at all. So it appears this is some kind of excuse that was made up. They just said, well, we'll just tell them this, even if it's not true. Do you know what I mean? I mean, this has happened before many, many times in many other incidents. And this pattern actually continued, because so many people were concerned about this. They were phoning the police, they were phoning the local newspapers, that the South Wales Argus, the local rag, the regional rag, actually produced a report on this, which said, there's nothing to worry about. Everything that happened that night was due to Exercise Chameleon, which was one of the standard military exercises that take place in that area, which of course cannot be the case. Personally, it was not announced in advance. They were presenting a lot of documents that looked as if they were like notices for residents. They were going to be doing this exercise at this date, so don't worry if you hear loud gunshots and bangs in the woods. Don't worry about that. And they said, well, we published this notice. But you see, these notices, that they there was no record of them existing before the 26th of February. So they were announcing that they were going to do an exercise with notices that they published after the so-called exercise. It doesn't make any sense. It's what's known in propaganda as backfilling. You create supposed evidence of a pre-knowledge of a particular event for whatever cover story you want, and then you publish evidence, fake evidence, that makes it look like it was there before the event happened, when it actually wasn't. So that was kind of the state of play. Kaz and Gary started investigating. They wrote a book called The Pensirk Incident, which is you can get at all good bookshops, and they started doing some more investigation. They found out, for example, there was a NOTAM, what's called a notice to airmen. This meant that the airspace above Pentwch, and in fact, a large area of South Wales, was actually closed that night. It was closed to all air traffic. In a way, it wouldn't be with an exercise. They were also asking for several other. In, there were several other things, strange things happened in the following days. For example, a group of people moved into the field where this incident happened. The field where the object appeared above Pentwch, and they set up camp there. A number of people put it, but they set up tents and things like that, and they seem to be going around with things that look like Geiger counters or detectors of various kinds. They had several pieces of equipment with them. It was all a little bit dubious, but some weird things happened. They had like guard dogs with them, like fierce Alsatians and things like that, which seemed a bit strange. Kaz actually warned them, it's lambing season, and The farmer will he actually the farmers patrol the fields to make sure their dogs are leaving the sheep alone and things like that, and they will shoot a dog that is threatening their sheep. And several people asked him. I mean, I actually got an independent witness, someone at the local pub who works at the local pub, told me this. Loads of people were sort of wondering what the hell's going on. They were going up and asking these guys who they are, and they gave a number of replies. One of them said they're from Vodafone, the mobile phone company, and they were just testing, doing like their general engineering survey, maybe putting up new masts and things like that. Someone else said they were a fracking survey team. For making their possible fracking site to get gas. Oh, they told these they told so they told at least two different cover stories, which doesn't make sense because one of them noticed that this guy's jacket, they were wearing these kind of orange jackets, like anoraks. One of them, the anorak was open, and he was able to see that this man had a pistol in a shoulder holster. How many Vodafone engineers go around tooled up? Doesn't make any sense, James. None at all. Kaz actually has got this is breaking evidence. This came up at this. She this is brand new evidence she introduced at the conference last week, and it is that. I'm just getting my notes here. There was one of the Freedom of Information actually put in said that they were declining. It was related directly to these strange people. They were all men. There was about a couple of dozen of them in this field. In these tents, all long rows of tents, like they were a very military style thing. Even though these people were not soldiers, apparently they weren't wearing uniforms. They were wearing these on orange anoraks, as I said. But she says, "Who are these people in the fields? I mean, are they?" I know that that's people who believe it was exercise chameleons said there was something to do with the exercise. They were probably from the Ministry of Defence. The reply she got was essentially a confession from the government. And it was, they said, we are refusing this Freedom of Information Act request on Section 23A exemption. And I've got the details of it all here. Yes, it's an absolute, it's an ex, it's Section 23 of the Freedom of Information Act 2000 declines requests even when the event is publicly framed as a routine exercise. Framed as a routine exercise, that's interesting. Absolute exemption. Unlike most exemptions, it's absolute. This means the MOD does not have to consider the public interest, and it gives a list of it involves a certain number of security bodies. Section 23 applies to information relating to the special forces, that is SAS, SBS, that is the Army, Royal Marines, MI5, the Security Service, that's MI5, the Secret Intelligence Service, that's known as MI6. And the General Communications Headquarters, that's GCHQ, it's the equivalent, it's basically the Electronic Intelligence Organization in Britain, the equivalent of the National Security Agency in the United States. This it, so any record of this becomes legally untouchable. They can also go under the neither confirm nor deny issue, where the MOD is not even required to confirm if they hold the information. Even knowing they argue that even confirming the presence of the file would reveal that a security body was involved in the Pentec incident that night. Now, this is unprecedented for something as benign and public as a military exercise. This is unprecedented and baffling, if that's what it was. So. That's the kind of state of play we're in right now, James. That's the basic overview of the entire issue up to this in everything in the last 10 years. And I do recommend Kaz and Gary's book for more details. So, but it's incredible, isn't it? It's a really, really weird incident.
Yeah, so where there's smoke, there's fire. It brings to mind the rather lame cover stories of the Phoenix Lights. Then they ro eventually they rolled out the Maryland Air National Guard conducting maneuvers, drills again involving flares. So they try to make after a fact, like you said, the backfilling a plausible, semi-plausible excuse. But what you just pointed out there strongly suggests some type of overt deep state involvement. You have GCHQ, you have a particular security classification that deals specifically with those intelligence agencies. I'm trying to recall some of the details I've seen from some of the documentaries and the podcasts I heard. I don't know if Kaz was the witness or someone else, but was it a fact that a portal seemed to open and this craft you described it earlier is decloaking in Kaz's words, like it suddenly just manifested. And I think the word also was slowly manifested. What were the other accounts? Did anyone describe something actually coming out of a hole in the sky?
I mean, well, this happens quite frequently, actually. It didn't just sort of like fly down from space. It didn't appear as a spot in the sky and then just slowly fly down, and then it just flew back up into the air. It's appeared. It seemed to come through. I mean, a portal is a good description of it. It just manifested itself in our world and then just faded back into nothing again. This is something that's occurred before in places like Skinwalker Ranch, for example. This is several people report this from the Skinwalker Ranch investigations, and there's many, many other examples. As if these objects have the ability to use wormholes. This is the Einstein-Rosen bridge, the idea that you can actually move from one part of the universe to the other in a form of shortcut. This, again, is used often in science fiction. You see it in Star Trek. They talk about warp speed, so they go faster than light and get to distant planets, despite the huge distance of space, in time for the next episode. But it happens. It's been reported in real UFO incidents, and this is one of them.
Well, what it tells me, all the activity prior to these events is at some level, some foreknowledge, some forewarning. And one can only speculate here. I would believe by this point that the deep state, call it what one will, has the sensors, has the monitoring equipment to let them know if a portal in our example is being opened. Maybe there's some kind of tickling of the fabric of reality that's picked up by their sensors, or conversely, and I'm sure there's more than two possible hypotheses, they were tipped off that somewhere along the line, some event of a UFO type nature was going to happen. Whether that tip came from other aliens that the deep state apparently is involved in, or through some other means, because it's okay at this point to conjecture, to speculate. We have, from what Kaz has pointed out with her book and your investigations, there's a template, but there's nothing wrong with trying to come up with some hypothesis. So what are your thoughts about the whole foreknowledge aspect? Because if they were there for several days and the air activities is increasing to the point where people are noticing it, and there was even a NOTAM, notice to airmen, that was issued, essentially making the whole of South Wales off limits to air travel, that to me smacks of foreknowledge. What are your thoughts on that, Ben?
This is one of the most intriguing questions of the entire incident. How do they know in advance? And indeed, this is, again, is not unique. In fact, there's another very significant UFO event in the same country from many, many years before. In January 1974, in northeast Wales, there was an event at the Bedouin Mountains. This is a very high, a rugged area of northeast Wales, where this time a spherical object appeared in a very similar way. And what was interesting at that point is that there was a again you people were seeing army lorries and things and driving along the roads before this happened. There was no clue in advance that this was going to happen. People report that the local military bases nearby, it appears troops were moved forward to the location before this incident happened, at least several days beforehand. The people report them in Llangollen and nearby towns, Llandrillo, several other of these strange towns, these little isolated towns, which don't normally see military presence. You don't normally get soldiers marching through the streets. There's no need for it, unless, again, it's an exercise, but there was no exercise at all in this case. Now, it's what's interesting is they know, for example, this the, considering the wide area that was under surveillance. So, for example, it was a huge, it wasn't just Pentwch, it wasn't just Llantrisant, it was a very large area of South Wales, almost everything north of Cardiff, as far as like Bryn Mawr and places like that. These areas were all off limits. So you're talking about several hundred square miles was closed to aerial vehicles. There was also a military presence on the ground in that entire area. There was also the plane, the air, the spot, the RAF spotter aircraft that was actually visible on flight radar, so could be traced publicly. Actually, a couple of times it actually flew across the Bristol Channels, as the English call it, and in Wales it's called the Severn Sea. This is the stretch of sea between South Wales and Southwest England. It flew across the Severn Sea backwards and forwards a couple of times, as if it was just checking that this thing wasn't going to appear in North Devon. That's in the southwest of England. So what this means is that the government didn't know exactly where this thing was going to land or where it was going to appear. They didn't know the exact spot. Otherwise, they could have like a big reception committee, again, like in Spielberg's Close Encounters movie. No, they didn't do that. They knew the rough area, the basic area where it was going to be, to the region, to within maybe 100 square miles in any direction. They knew it was kind of going to be in that area. They didn't know exactly where in that area, but they narrowed it down to a region. And the same thing happened with Berwyn Mountains in 1974. They knew more or less where it was going to appear, but the fact that they deployed the troops so widely indicated they didn't know the exact spot. But I mean, the military responded so quickly to the arrival of the circular object. Again, there was an explosion and there was this circular object. There was literally men on the mountain in 45 minutes, which would have been impossible unless you had four deployed troops in the roughly in the same area. That's very, very strange indeed. Very strange element of this case. It makes you wonder. I mean, you mentioned that they were tipped off or they have some kind of equipment. If so, then this is completely black budget, and it's in the sort of secret space program world, because they certainly don't talk about that. I mean, if you look at the Royal Air Force, for example, they have search radar. We have like all kinds of like patrol aircraft that can pick up Russian bombers and things like that. But spaceship, alien spacecraft, and they have like something. It can't be radar. It must be some other kind of sensory system that they don't tell us about. Maybe something involving like a quantum tunneling or something like that. I don't know. So we're dealing with very, very secretive and very, very covert deep state machinations here, James.
Has there been any indication from police forces of foreknowledge? Was there any unusual police activity? Because it sounds like Kaz and the others had submitted freedom of information requests to the MOD, etc. But how
Yeah.
about the local police? So were there any information coming out of them?
From what I gather, I mean, Kaz and Gary will give you a more detailed answer on this if you ever get a chance to speak to them. But from what I gather, the local police did play a role in keeping the public away from the areas in question. In terms of Smilog Woods in particular, there was the local police force were there sealing off the roads, putting in roadblocks, and not letting people through. This is con What's concerning about this is that, the fact they didn't want people entering the area where the Atlantis and the Smilog Woods area is because there was some kind of re crash retrieval operation going on there. It seems all the signs are there for a Roswell-style crash retrieval operation. Now, the explosion that rocked the hospital, the Royal Glamorgan Hospital, was shaken as if in an earthquake, which must have done serious damage to the building. Although, I mean, Kaz and Gary did actually try to get some information from the National Health Service and interview local staff members and things like that. But there was another incident, like a helicopter gunship from the US Air Force, Apache. It made an it just literally just after that, it made an emergency landing at Cardiff Roose Airport, which is a rather strange thing to do. It was obviously in serious danger. It couldn't stay in the air, so the nearest place it could go was this civilian airport. What we don't know for certain, but what appears to have happened is there was some kind of violent engagement. I mean, this is a I don't know this for certain. There's some kind of possibility there was a violent engagement between the military and these objects. This would account for the presence of the aircraft. The explosion was a detonating warhead. And then something crashed in the woods as if it was damaged, like an aircraft coming down, although it wasn't an aircraft. That's along with the police presence, the police closing the roads, military, it all sort of adds up. Do you know what I mean, James? And Kaz, I know maybe we're getting slightly ahead of ourselves here, but Kaz actually gave another piece of information regarding Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Oh,
I
what
don't know
did he
if you
say?
She said the right. She said about Wright Patterson Air Force Base, something very interesting. Now, Wright Patterson Air Force Base is it's not as famous as Area 51, but really it should be, because before even before Area 51 was built, because Area 51 didn't exist before about 1955, the technical data section, which started in World War II, I believe, was stationed at Wright Patterson Air Force Base. And the very last thing we heard in the media in July 1947, when the Roswell incident happened, was the remains of these disc, the flying disc that was captured, were being taken to Wright Pat. That is the what was called Wright Field in those days, which was the technical data section where basically anything foreign you pick up. It could be like a it could be a German fighter pilot, a German fighter plane or something like that, was taken there to be analyzed by the scientists. Now, apparently that role still exists. That role at Wright Pat still exists. And there's a lady called Dr. Irina Scott, who's written a book called Sacred Corridors, which describes the presence of Wright Patterson Air Force Base. So, and very often this is the first, when something strange is picked up, it very often goes there before it goes to Area 51. And it might even go to other bases as well. But it seems like Wright Patterson plays a crucial role in those kind of operations. Now, Kaz spoke to a man who doesn't want to go public just yet, who was actually, he was in the US Air Force, and he said that on the 27th of February of 2016, an aircraft landed with something strange, which was taken to what they call the spooky hangar. And this is the place where they deal with the most classified operations, and no one goes in there unless you're directly involved with the operations. This, I believe, is what, I think it's called Hangar, is it Hangar 5? Irina says it calls it something. Irina refers to this hangar as well in her book, but she doesn't. She gives it a different name. And all he knew was this object was, which was covered in like a tarpaulin, was lifted out of the aircraft by a forklift and just taken into the hangar. And that's all he knows. Now, there's no direct evidence this connects Pentach. There's no direct evidence, but it was the following day. That's the only thing that makes me believe there may be a connection here. And also the fact that whenever these sorts of things happen around the world, as James Fox has said in his latest documentary, for whatever reason, the United States seems to be the central organizing force in these kinds of operations, not just within its own territory, but across the world. And even in this post, we now live in this post-Cold War kind of multipolar world. But despite this, the United States is still seems to be the biggest player on the block when it comes to UFO crash retrievals, whichever country they are. We see this. I mean, there is this air traffic controller who appears in James's documentary about the Varginha incident in Brazil. This was in 1996, where she says that a US Air Force plane landed, and the Americans came out and said, "We'll take it from here," and they immediately took over the operation from the Brazilians. To be Brazilians were like putting the creature in hospitals and things like that. They didn't really know what to do with it. That seems to that again would fit with this coincidental timing the following day, and the fact the US was involved. Maybe there may be a relation there to Pentair.
We've seen that pattern before. You just referenced Varginha. That was a classic example. Also, the case, and if memory serves, Anthony Dodd, a late and well-known, highly regarded UFO researcher from the UK, talked a lot about the what's been referred to in some circles as the South African shoot down. That's
Oh,
what I call it.
yes.
And that was another example because, according to his sources, a deal was cut. Part of the deal apparently involved turning a blind eye to the South African at the time nuclear development program, in probably even providing them materials and equipment in exchange for the recovery of the craft. Apparently, if the story timeline is correct in my mind, NORAD had alerted the South African government that a UFO was flying in their airspace. Some jets were scrambled out of Valhalla Air Base, and they managed to shoot the craft down. And then they found a couple, the story, found a couple of quite miffed, understandably, aliens on board. Apparently, one of the ETs had a go at one of the lab scientists there in South Africa. But long story short was, pretty soon, an air transport arrived from America, the U.S. Air Force, and the craft and its occupants were taken back to Wright Pat. And the part of Wright Pat that you're talking about oftentimes involves the Foreign Technology Division, the FTD, which is where worldwide missile development, information and equipment, airplane, jet information from foreign countries, they all go to the Foreign Technology Division, including alien technology. And there were other examples of that where there was a, oh, the Kandahar Giant is a classic example of that. If the story is correct from what we've heard, after the
Afghanistan, yeah.
Kandahar Giant was slain, a retrieval team came from Wright Pat, of all places. They loaded up the big stinky giant onto the aircraft. I don't know what type of aircraft it was. They have a number of large aircraft at their disposal, C-5, C-17, C-141s, flew it back to Wright Pat. So the form is well established, as you point out, Ben. And I think the timing is significant because clearly it didn't, the plane didn't bring in the entire pyramidal shaped craft. It would have been too large, maybe a chunk of it, maybe one of the barrel shaped objects that were
That's what I'm
sighted. Now,
thinking, yeah.
one part of the story that I thought was interesting, and again has echoes from other cases that we've heard from, right? Jonathan Wigand talks about being down in Peru, and the Marine Corps anti-aircraft battery he was a part of was
Yes,
ordered to
that's
shoot down a craft, right? And then eventually a recovery team came from America and hauled the thing away. Now, tell us about the story, because what I've seen in animations and dramatizations of part of the event at Pinterest was this large craft comes out of a portal, and then out of the large craft itself, these barrel-shaped objects come out. And I was given to understand, or maybe I didn't understand it correctly when I saw these documentaries, but somehow, some way, maybe through some directed energy means, they brought down one or more of these barrel-shaped craft. Maybe that was one of the smaller ones that were brought to Wright Pat. Who knows? But what are your thoughts about some kind of exotic weaponry being deployed to bring down the smaller craft that exited the larger craft?
It's quite likely that something was used against these vehicles that is not you don't find in an average arsenal, and I do think it probably was one of the barrel probably was one of the barrel shaped objects or something similar that actually crashed in Smilog Woods and was taken to Wright Patterson. The foreign technical the foreign FTD, the Foreign Technical D Division, I think is simply the technical data section as it is today. I think there's lots of talk about the fact that the government has some kind of weapon that is beyond anything we could imagine in terms of like what we are told is the cutting edge of military technology. And when it comes to directed energy, it might involve the what you might call particle beams. There's something called the Hutchison effect. The Canadian guy called John Hutchison discovered it, and he was supervised. I mean, there was this guy turned up at his laboratory and supervised him for a couple of months, called Colonel John Alexander, who's quite well known today on the UFO circuit, and he speaks at conferences and things. He was actually working for DARPA in those days, which was the early 1980s, and he took a very, very close interest in John's work, and John would. What he would do is he would use interference effects from different transmissions to create effects such as the ability to break down solid matter into like fume, and even to create levitation, spontaneous fire without heat, things like all kinds of things like that. And we also know like there have been occasions that have been reported where soldiers will attempt, and sometimes pilots of military aircraft. Most usually, it's pilots and military aircraft will attempt to engage a UFO with conventional weapons. That would be a cannon, missile, things like this. And on almost all those occasions, the humans come off worse off. In other words, the UFOs seem not to be. It's impossible to harm these UFOs with conventional weapons. If you shoot at them, the bullets just have no effect. They just go seem to just dissolve. And reports like this go back to World War II, the Foo Fighters and things like that. A guy called Graham Rendell has written a book about that. if you fire a missile at it, the missile doesn't reach its target. And very often, even you can't even open, you can't even release the weapon because the electronics of the aircraft will shut down. They'll break down. Which again is a repeat recurring pattern we see, even like with Kaz and the others with their mobile phones. They couldn't film this object because the mobile phones wouldn't work. So, in my view, the weapon they used was probably something a bit more exotic than a bullet or a gun or a missile. The fact is, the fact that we did hear an explosion, we did hear a detonating warhead, indicates that they may have tried that first unsuccessfully. That's my speculation, but that's what I think is possibly the case. And some there's another thing I want. You mentioned Tony Dodd, and I there's a which like, there's a little side there. It's quite interesting. Do you want to know what it is? Can I tell
Please.
you? Yeah, no problem. And Tony had a friend. Now he never named this person, but this was a guy who said that he was in the special forces, and he was involved in UFO crash retrievals. He was part of an international organization that actually did this very thing. Now when Tony died. He left a lot of his notes, his records to trustworthy sources, and one of them was a man called Richard D. Hall, a fellow British a researcher, who actually approached this man with a, it was a, there was a local man as well in this was also in Wales, this was in South Wales. There was a local man called Derek Goff who helped him with that and put him in touch with this guy, this friend of Tony's. The man actually told him some very interesting stories about his duties. Later on, he broke contact with Richard and Darren and just and Derek, Richard and Derek, and then disappeared. But enough information, we've got enough information to indicate that the government does have organizations in the Ministry of Defence for dealing with this. And what's more, we can tell that because they seem to know what they're doing. This is very interesting. Now, in Brazil, when the craft came down at Varginha in Brazil in 1996, the local police and the emergency services, the local military base, which is actually an academy, they didn't have a clue what to do with this thing. They were really panicking, and they said, well, this is why they took it to two hospitals. With Pentarch, it's different. You see a group of guys turn up, put their tents up, get their equipment out, all kinds of electronics. They knew what they were doing, which indicates this is not the first time they've done something like this, James. They've done it before.
Yes,
Which
form is well
I want.
established.
Yeah, I wonder how many times. I wonder how far this goes back. But they have a contingency plan, obviously.
Well, from what I recall reading at least one of Tony Dodd's books, I recall a part in there about a crash retrieval that he described, and his military source could have been the same guy that you're talking about. I don't know. He talked about one crash site and there were not only gray aliens there, but there was also a reptilian there. And according to Tony Dodd's sources, when they did an autopsy on this reptilian, they found a lot of nanotech in swimming around in what passes for its bloodstream. So I remember when I read that years ago, I go, well, that's interesting. And then as time goes on, we hear more and more talk about nanotech, nanocircuitry, what have you. And then I flash back to what Tony Dodd had uncovered all those years ago, that at least in one of these beings, if the story is true, it had nanotech in it. So it was under some degree of control itself. I mean, just how high and how deep does this thing go, right? In the time we got left in the first segment, I want you to touch a bit about, and we'll delve more into this in the second segment, but one of the predictable aftermaths of the Pentarish event was the clampdown and the harassment meted out to the witnesses, including Kaz Clark. Tell us a bit about that, because that is a common feature we hear in a lot of these stories you referenced earlier about how there were kidnappings, the basically detainments, people held against their will by the authorities because they got too close or they had seen things. Probably read the Riot Act. Give your thoughts about that before we take our break.
I will indeed. If I could, I could tell you my own story related to that as well. Now,
Oh,
as
let's
far as
hear it,
Kaz.
yeah.
Yeah, well, as far as Kaz goes, I mean, she could tell this story herself much better than I could, but she does report strange people coming to see her. Now, Kaz is very open; she's very friendly, and if you want to speak to her. You can turn up in Pentach, and you just contact her beforehand and say, "I want to come and visit the crash site." She'll go and show you the landing site. She'll show you the place where she saw these objects, and she'll do interviews with people in the media. If she, you know, and loads of people have been there. Paranormal scholar, this lady from Swansea, she went there and did a really long, really great interview with Kaz. It's been on the Y Files recently. The Channel 4 did one as well. That one man turned up. He was a very strange individual, actually, who kept, I can't remember the details, but Kaz got very uncomfortable with him. He wouldn't identify himself. He gave him what appears to be a fake name, and he kept saying some weird stuff. I can't remember the details, but I'll tell you what, I myself, something very strange happened to me in 2019. I was in February 2019. I went to Denmark. I went to Denmark to do a talk for the UFO Denmark organization. So I went to Copenhagen. I don't know if you've ever, you know, Pia Knudsen. Do you know Pia Knudsen? She's quite well known.
Oh, no, I'm not familiar with her.
All right, she runs this thing called, along with a guy called Carsten, who runs this group called UFO Denmark, and they meet at this venue in Copenhagen, and they invited me to do a talk for them. And so I said I would do a talk about British UFOs because I'm British and they'd be interested in that, being Danish. And I said that I cover some of the less well-known cases because everyone's heard of Rendlesham Forest, haven't they? I mean, it's like, I thought, we don't want to do that again. That's just old hat. So I covered a number of I covered a number of incidents which are not so well known in internationally, or in even in my own country, and I included the Pentach incident, which at the time I was literally the only person really reporting on this. Everyone else wasn't in really not interested. And this is the first time I've been to Denmark, never been there before. And I suddenly realized before I left, and I said this to Pia, I said, "This is the first time," I mentioned this to Kaz as well, "this is the first time this incident has ever been reported on internationally, an international event. It's never been discussed internationally before at any conference or any other group meeting." And about a week before I left, I had a phone call. I mean, on my landline. Now, my landline is ex-directory. There's no one knows that number except people, my friends, my family, and my housemates. And most of their family live in Sudan. You know, they're foreign. And indeed, if their friends want to talk to them, they use their mobile phone. So I thought, who's this? And it was, I the moment I heard, I didn't recognize the voice. A red flag went up. This person was someone I didn't know, but he said in a very posh accent, he said, "Is that Ben Emlyn Jones?" I said, "Yes." And he said, "I think you should stay away from Kaz Clark. Have nothing to do with her. She's a con woman." Or he said, he either said con woman or con artist. And I don't know because I interrupted him. And I said, "Who is this?" And he replied, "It doesn't matter who I am. Just a friendly word of advice. Stay away from Kaz Clark." I said, "Who are you?" But he put the phone down. Now I contacted my phone provider and I said, "Look, I've had this weird phone call. Do you know anything about it?" And they were very nice about it, but they weren't very helpful. They just sent me this package on how to deal with nuisance phone calls and things like that. So that's weird. I mean, there was an ex-directory number, somebody I didn't know. Literally a week before I was going to go to Denmark and talk about the Pentach incident for the first time, and he's warning me to stay away from the principal witness. What's going on? Strange, very, very strange.
It's like you were being warned off. Geez, where there's smoke, there's fire. Well, Ben, tell our listeners how they can find you and your work online.
Actually, if you want to know anything about me, simply go to Hpanwo. Just put in the search box, it's Hpanwo. That stands for Hospital Porters Against the New World Order. And also, check out my book, Roswell Rising, A Novel of Disclosure. Now, this is a fictional book, but if you listen to James's show, you will really like this because it's fiction. It's a fictional book, but it's all about the kind of subjects that we talk about. And it's about the Roswell incident and things associated with it. So, A Novel of Disclosure should certainly get you intrigued. So, I hope you check that out. It's available at all good bookshops now, £10 in the UK.
And to our dear listeners out there, if you like what we do, if you believe in what we do, please go to thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up and become a member, and we'll see you at the top of the next segment.